to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Caribou and red squirrels are two species that are close to the heart of biologist Dr. Stan Bouton. His research on these animals and other boreal issues has earned him a fellowship in the Royal Society of Canada. And the next time you toss a baseball or watch some kids play soccer, ask yourself where the money comes from to support these sports teams. Dr. Dan Mason is looking at the impact that gaming revenues have on the survival of sports associations in Alberta. The story is coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Dr. Stan Bouton is famous for his research on red squirrels and boreal ecology. He currently is a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta, where he holds an NSERC industrial chair in integrated landscape management. And Stan is among the new inductees to the prestigious scientific organization, the Royal Society of Canada.
Well, it's a really nice indication that I guess some people at least view that the sorts of things we're doing is worthwhile. And it's always be very nice to be judged by one's peers and be judged positively. And getting elected as a fellow to the Royal Society is certainly an indication that people appreciate the work we're doing.
Well, I'm curious, what's the process? How does one become elected as a fellow?
Well, it's really interesting in that it requires that you actually be nominated by someone else. You can't apply yourself and say, please let me in. It's someone else has to do the nominating, and it's a fairly detailed process in terms of the nomination, and you have to have at least a couple of people already in the society put the nomination forward. There has to be a series of letters talking about your work or assessing your work. And then you obviously have to submit a pretty clear outline of the work that you've done and what it has achieved in the field. And then it gets assessed by, I believe, by external review and then by all of the members in the society before it's decided as to whether a person should be allowed in or elected in as one of the fellows. So it's a very detailed process. I have a lot of thanks to give to the people who did the hard work, took the time to actually put my nomination forward.
Well, the Royal Society of Canada, what role does it actually play in the scientific community?
Yeah, I think its role is still relatively minor at this point. It's not in the same realm as, for example, the National Science Foundation in the U.S., where there are a number of sections within that foundation that are tasked with doing very important sorts of summaries, assessments of issues and things like that that often get submitted then to Congress or to the politicians for decision making. I think that the Royal Society of Canada has started to do some of that, but is not nearly as active or as influential. So I hope that over the next little while, one of the jobs that I'll try and take on is to see if we can actually raise that profile more and basically create the opportunity for scientists to weigh in on a number of these important societal issues.
Well, that's certainly a reflection of the proactive role you've taken in the work that you've done, especially in looking at integrated landscape management and what we can do about our boreal ecosystems. What are some of the things that you have been working on recently?
One of the things that's really occupied a lot of my time recently, actually, is woodland caribou conservation. And it's a big issue right across the country because woodland caribou have been declining on the southern part of the country, and as a consequence, it's raised major concerns as an endangered species, which directly feeds back to industry being very concerned that their social license to operate is in jeopardy because of having to deal with this species. And it's no more apparent than right here in Alberta, where caribou populations are in real trouble. We actually have fairly large numbers of woodland caribou relative to other parts of the country. So in some ways, we're obligated to be more careful with them. But at the same time, they're facing extreme pressure from the level of human activity they see on their ranges.
Well, their range is right in the middle of the oil and gas activity in northern Alberta, isn't it?
What isn't in the middle of oil and gas activity in Alberta, you're quite right, is they live in forested or boggy types of habitat throughout the north and the western part of the province, and virtually all of their range is underlain by things that are extremely valuable or by things above it, like the forests, because there's also an interaction with forestry here as well.
You're actually on sabbatical right now, and you're doing a lot of writing, and you're putting together a book. What's your book about?
Well, it's just in a conceptual level at the present time, but a colleague of mine, Dennis Murray, who was actually a master's student with me and has gone on to be a professor at Trent University, we've cooked the idea that there's a need for a book that talks about predation and its role in shaping lots of the ecology that we see in our world. And both Dennis and I have worked and had a love for the issues related to predation, and so we're going to try and pull together a book that we're going to call something like Nature's Tooth and Claw, Vertebrate Predation and Its Effects on Ecosystems.
Well, give me an example.
Well, if you look at my career, I've been involved in predation from quite a few standpoints. One of the first things I ever worked on was this snowshoe hare lynx cycle. And the neat thing about that is throughout the boreal forest, lynx and hares go up and down with a regular period of every 10 years. They go from virtually no animals present to them all over the place. You can't look around in the forest when they're at their high without seeing a snowshoe hare and having really lots of encounters with lynx. So why the cycles? Why this interaction between the two species? And we did a series of large-scale experiments up in the Yukon looking at manipulating things like predation by excluding predators out of areas with electric fences and looking at how the snowshoe hares responded. And those experiments were actually have become quite influential in ecology in general and were, I think, a real big component of why I got into the Royal Society. Actually, they've been very important. But then recently, the caribou story is another predator-prey story, and that's a neat one because caribou are interesting beasts that they live in places where no other animal wants to live, these low productivity peatlands where it's tough to get around, and we think they do that because that's the only place they can avoid their primary predator, the wolf. And the wolf is a lot smarter, if you will, and it hangs out in upland areas where there's lots of moose and other prey. But if you get any sort of changes take place that lead to increased overlap between moose and caribou, the caribou really take it on the chin. And we think that overlap has changed immensely in Alberta, again, because of our human activities leading to creation of habitat that's good for moose and deer. The wolves like that. They continue to feed on those species. Their numbers go up. And as a sideline, whenever they encounter caribou, they also kill them. And that means very bad things for the caribou populations.
Now, when you talk about that change of habitat, is that related to seismic lines and those kinds of roads of access?
Well, we don't know the exact mechanism yet, but there's two possibilities. One is that we simply change the hunting efficiency of the predators by creating things like seismic lines and roads, which the predators can travel rapidly down. And the greater the area the animal, the predator can search, the more likely it's going to find some prey. So if you speed up its travel, you probably improve its hunting efficiency. But the other issue, probably the more important thing, is how do we change the predator numbers? And we do that by, as I say, creating good habitat for the main prey, which are moose and deer. And forestry does that in a big way because it creates young forests. And we think oil and gas, energy sector does the same thing to a smaller extent by creating lots of edges with the linear features and by creating well sites that have forage that's much more favorable for these animals than you would have seen in a natural boreal forest.
Now, some of the other work you've done is with red squirrels, and I talked to you not that long ago about your discovery that there's been an impact from climate change on what happens with their mating cycles and that. Any follow-up from that?
Well, we continue to follow the climate change evolution part of the Red Squirrel story. The issue was that we found that they've advanced breeding dates by about 3 weeks over three generations in the north, and part of that's due to climate. And the way they do it is phenotypic changes, i.e. they have some ability as an individual to respond to these new conditions, but there's also a genetic component, meaning that the squirrels we see now differ somewhat genetically from the squirrels we saw three generations ago. It's not that there's major mutations, it's just the frequency of genes that drive what they do has changed over time. So that was pretty exciting, because now there's more examples of that ability to adapt to climate change showing up from other studies, but ours is one of the first ones to actually show it. So we're doing experiments related to that, but actually the last little while I've been working on another neat aspect of red squirrels, and we've just finished the last day or so a paper that we're going to send off here to for review that shows some other very exciting things. These little characters live on spruce seed, and that seed is produced in what we call masting events. So the trees, every so often, all team up, if you will, and all produce major amounts of cones and seed in the same year. And in other years, there will be absolutely no seed. So big changes in the food supply of the squirrels. And normally in these systems, what happens is that the seed consumers track that production of seed, but always lagging behind it. So in other words, you can't produce extra babies till you have that new food. So as a result, you're always behind the trees, if you will, or behind the production of the food. And that leads to, again, to cycles, boom and bust dynamics in most systems. Well, these characters have outsmarted the trees to some extent, and now we're finding that they show anticipatory reproduction. They actually crank up their reproduction and increase population size before the cones are available for them to feed on in the autumn. So they're using some sort of environmental cue to say, hey, it's going to be a big year with lots of food in the system, so I'm going to increase the frequency of breeding, I'm going to have bigger litters, and I'm going to produce a second litter in the summer to get as many babies out there as possible so they can take advantage of that seed when it becomes mature. And that's, again, a first. There's no other systems that have shown that. They all lag behind. These guys anticipate, they get rid of that time lag, and so they're in some ways beating the tree at its own game, because some think the reason this masting occurs is because the trees synchronize their production, and then that swamps the seed predator, allowing more seeds to escape and germinate. Well, this predator is counteracting that by saying, hey, I'm going to try and anticipate this. They, in fact, do it. And so their numbers are right at the maximum of when the seed comes available. So in some ways, there's this little game going on between the tree and the squirrel, and both are doing some really neat things to try and counteract each other.
Boy, when you look at all of that, what lessons can we draw as humans?
Well, I guess what always hits me is, you know, we're not that smart. We think we have all this sort of superiority over being able to manage our environment, change it, etc. And I just am continually fascinated how many of these organisms living in these systems actually have a lot of adaptations, a lot of skills, if you will, to cope with some very, very tough conditions. And that gives me hope in that I think we are marching along doing pretty gross things to a lot of our ecology and many of our environments. And many animals won't be able to cope with it, but there's certainly some that will even be able to put up with the crap that we continue to throw at them in some ways. And so I think gives us some hope to, I think, we can actually do some things to restore ecosystems, get them back to the way they should be, to maintain some of the important functions that we see in ecosystems, and hopefully coexist with many of the species we see on this planet.
Thank you very much, Stan.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Stan Booten, a professor in biological sciences at the University of Alberta, where he holds an NSERC industrial chair in integrated landscape management. Stan was recently elected as a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. It seems like we've barely recovered from the Stanley Cup playoffs of last spring, and already hockey season is underway. From professional sports teams right down to neighborhood clubs, finding the money to keep these sports groups financially viable is an ongoing concern. And certainly for amateur sports associations, they're dependent on the revenues that come from gaming activities like lotteries, casinos, and bingos. With the help of the Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Dr. Dan Mason is investigating the impact of gaming revenues on sporting activities. Dan is an associate professor in the Faculty of Physical Education and Recreation at the University of Alberta.
Well, if you look at the sport delivery system, you have your clubs and teams, and then you also have the provincial sport associations, which sort of are the umbrella organizations that try and oversee the interests of the entire province and act as sort of a liaison between national level associations and the clubs and teams. And so traditionally you've seen a number of different sources of gaming revenue being pumped into these clubs and teams and also the associations. And so in the province of Alberta, you have the Alberta Lottery Fund money that actually gets trickles down into the associations through actual grants, development grants, but also through the teams and clubs and associations being able to actually put forward proposals to host things like casinos and bingos and raffles and that sort of thing. So the teams, the clubs and the associations will get money from sponsorships and memberships and that sort of thing, but you're seeing some of them actually get a fair bit of their resources from gaming revenues.
Do you have any indication of what the overall amount of money is that goes from gaming into sports?
It would vary immensely. I mean, there are some individuals and groups who are actually not necessarily interested in using gaming revenues. And so you do tend to see certain associations or certain individuals within those associations who are actually trying to look for other ways other than gaming revenues to actually access resources for their respective organizations. So we do have some information from our research that we know how much development grants are going to the provincial sport associations, but those aren't numbers necessarily that we can divulge. I can say that the ASRPWF, the Alberta Sports Recreation Parks and Wildlife Foundation, doesn't like to see any more than 50% of the revenues of any given provincial sport association coming from development grants.
But we are talking in the millions of dollars.
When you look at all the associations, potentially, yes.
Now, the research that you've been working on, you've been looking at the impact of gaming revenue on amateur sports in Alberta. What got you interested in that?
Well, Ian Reid, who's another member of the faculty here, several years ago, he and I got to talking about the relationships that people who are members of these sport clubs and teams have with their respective associations with regards to looking at ways in which they're trying to generate revenues. And so you have people who have been asked to work at casinos or do bingos, and there's a number of people who actually don't necessarily want to do that because they have issue with the ways in which the money is, you know, where the money's coming from, basically. And so that sort of was an initial spark for us to look at this. And then as we looked further into the problem, we could see that there's a number of different ways in which gaming-related revenues are funneled into amateur sport in the province. And so initially that was our drive. And so our initial grant application actually investigated or wanted to investigate just that relationship that exists between gaming revenues and funding from gaming revenues and the provincial sport associations that were receiving the funds.
So what is it that you actually ended up doing to get the information that you needed? How did you do your study?
Well, initially we thought we were going to be doing focus groups with, and we had planned on setting up an internet website where there would be a survey instrument that would be able to capture this information. But Ian Reid was able to establish a relationship with the ASRPWF and access some of the numbers that we were looking for with regards to the amounts that were going to this specific association. So that was a great help to the project. And so the master's student that has been working on this project, and his work is the meat and potatoes, so to speak, of this grant. What he did instead was then went to a sample of the provincial sport associations and interviewed executive directors and other heads to find out their views on you know, what they felt about the money coming and what type of pressures that they were experiencing as a result of having to jump through hoops and do certain things in order to gain access to these revenues on an annual basis.
So what did you find out?
Basically, the development grant comes to these associations, and so some of them don't necessarily like to be too reliant upon those development grants, and so what they've done is they've tried to find more resources from elsewhere, so sponsorships and that sort of thing. Also, there is a reporting system that's set up where they have to provide information on characteristics of their associations that they then have to give to the ASRPWF to in order to receive their funding. And so there were some issues and concerns related to that process itself and what you had to go through in order to gain access to the resources and whether or not that actually influenced the amount of resources that they were going to receive.
What about the idea of people feeling uncomfortable either getting gaming revenues for their clubs or having to work in casinos and bingos and that sort of thing in order to get the funds they need for their kids to play soccer or play hockey?
Right. Well, at this stage, we were looking at it on a little further up the food chain. So we were looking at the provincial sport associations that then oversee the individual clubs. But I think one of the things that we did find was that there is a fairly, regardless of the actual percentage of money that comes from these development grants from the ASRPWF, there's a situation that the associations feel themselves in where they, regardless of whether or not they ethically are feel as though it's the appropriate thing to do, they're in a position where they have to rely on these grants in order to continue to operate. And so that's put them in a bit of a difficult position. And so if things were a little bit more munificent in the sense that there was more money that was able to be acquired by these associations from other sources, then you'd probably see them being able to make more of a stand ethically if they felt it was not appropriate to get that money. But right now it's, you know, they need this money in order to continue to operate. So that's what they're doing right now.
Now that you've finished up this project, what further research is that leading to?
Well, I'm currently working on a research project with Gordon Walker and two individuals from the United States, John Whitehead and Bruce Johnson. And really what we're interested in doing is finding out whether or not the public even knows that this is where the money's coming from. So, for example, we're not even sure whether people even know outside of these provincial sport associations or these clubs where this money's coming from and whether or not they feel that this is appropriate. So this is sort of a project trying to figure out what their awareness of and their willingness to continue to use gaming revenues to support amateur sports, culture, recreation, and professional sports teams in the province.
What's your sense at this point of what the feeling is?
I'm a little bit reluctant to talk about that because we're in the data analysis phase, but I think that there's a tendency for people to not see it as being appropriate. Another element that's been introduced into things, I think, because of the circumstances that the province is in right now, is that everyone feels as though we're rolling in money because of the resources that are available within the province. And so because of that, I think there's a reluctance on the part of taxpayers to see more of their own money going into anything, whether it be the arts or culture or sport or recreation. And so I think that there's a little bit, we're probably going to see a little bit of a reluctance to use any of those resources because they probably say, well, just take it out of my rebate check or take it out of the Heritage Fund or that sort of thing. So I think that's probably what we're going to see, a little bit of an influence that on the findings that we have.
Well, if you look ahead to the big picture, how would this research be useful in terms of maybe changing the situation of funding?
Well, the methodology that we're using, or the method that we're using to look at this, is called contingent valuation method, which is an economics method that's used to try and put a value on public goods or put a value on things that don't have any kind of market value. And so it's been used to look at things such as environmental change. So, for example, you can't put a value on cleaning up a swamp or a wetland, but people are sometimes willing to pay that in order to see some type of improvement or change. And so it's the same logic that's being used for sport here. So the logic would be, well, would you like to see, how much would you be willing to pay out of your tax dollars to see more recreational opportunities for people or an improvement in people's general health or more access to resources that will allow them to engage in physical activity? And so that's really where this is going. So the policy implications would be that we could actually potentially put a dollar value on how much taxpayers in the province of Alberta are willing to pay to see money go towards these sources. So we may find that people don't want to see any money go into these things, which in itself has a policy implications. We may find that they want to see more money going to it. But this hasn't been done in this province before, so I think it's very, very important to get a feel for where people are at with regards to the use of public money to go towards these types of activities.
What else do you think this research will lead to?
Well, the final phase of the current grant that we're working at, is going to be looking at the public's willingness to use gaming revenues to support the professional sports teams in the province, specifically the Calgary Flames and the Edmonton Oilers. And one of the significant problems that we've seen in North America is this so-called stadium game, where cities are forced to pay money to publicly fund or publicly finance facilities or provide other money to help support teams. And in the province of Alberta, obviously, and specifically in Edmonton, we've seen concern over the last 10 years or so about the departure of the team and what are some of the things that can be done. And so we have seen a scratch-off lottery being introduced to fund the sports teams to help to give some additional revenues to the clubs. We've seen the province of Alberta enact a special NHL players tax to tax the players playing in the province of Alberta, and that money was being turned over to the teams themselves. And so, but what hasn't happened is we really don't have a feel for what the public thinks about this and whether they're actually willing to see this happen. And so the co-investigators that are working on the project with me, they've actually looked at this situation in the United States in certain settings. One of the settings was Pittsburgh, and in 1999, the Pittsburgh Penguins were going bankrupt. And so what they did is they did a survey to find out what the average taxpayer was willing to pay to keep the Penguins in Pittsburgh. And it turns out that the amount that the citizens of Pittsburgh were willing to pay was far less than what the Penguins were valued. But in theory, if the value to the taxpayer was greater than the cost of the team or the cost of an arena, for example, then in theory it would make sense from a public policy perspective for the province or the city to step in and to pay for the team. So what I'm interested in and what we're interested in this second phase of the project is actually find out what that willingness to pay is on the part of rural Albertans, Edmontonians, and Calgarians. And so it's going to be very, very interesting because it'll actually give us a number that you could work off of, saying, well, this is how much the team is worth to the citizens of Edmonton. So, for example, if Edmonton needs a new arena, how much should the public be willing to put in? And what's the acceptable level of that? And so that's going to be very, very interesting. And there are some fairly significant policy implications, I think, coming out of that.
Well, you've certainly got your work cut out for you. Thank you very much, Dan.
Thanks.
That was Dr. Dan Mason, an associate professor in physical education and recreation at the University of Alberta. His research is supported by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Innovation and Science, Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Conservation Association, Calgary Technologies Inc., Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, and Science Alberta Foundation. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crocher.